listen to shoot the defence. It's unbelievable, Jeff.
Hello and welcome to another special interview edition of Shooter Defence. My name is Michael Pieri and today's guest is an award-winning entrepreneur, having established his first football coaching business into becoming the largest football coaching provider in East Yorkshire and going on to be recognised among the top 100 best business startups in the UK in 2010. With over 10 years coaching experience, my guest today has worked as an academy coach at Rochdale AFC, being director of coaching with Arsenal Soccer Schools and as a manager at semi-professional level with Ecclesfield United FC, alongside coaching at grassroots, working with boys and girls, and as head coach at college and university senior level within the men's and women's game. With a master's degree in performance coaching, he's a qualified A-licensed coach, Advanced Youth Award at 2. My guest is the director of coaching at MYSL, MSPSP Soccer Club, Eastside FC, in Grosser Pointe, Michigan, and responsible for player and coach development of boys and girls teams from under 7s to under 18s, encompassing some 800 players. Like yours truly, he's also a qualified teacher and has worked internationally with players from the USA, Europe, Africa and Oceania. My guest is also a motivational speaker, and while he has many talents, today's interview would largely centre on his book titled Let's Talk Soccer, using game calls to develop communication and decision-making in football, where he believes implementing what he calls game calls into coaching practice can help develop footballers onto higher levels. Ladies and gentlemen, I present to you Gerard Jones. Gerard, welcome to the show, and thank you for agreeing to be interviewed. How are you?
Very good. It's a good intro. It's interesting listening to it. Yeah.
Must be. Everyone says that. First question is easy, Gerard. Talk us through your coaching journey. How did you start? Why did you start?
It's a good question. I mean, literally, I've been coaching since I was about 14, 15 years old. Started off really when I was at Halifax Town as a youth team player. I was playing for the youth team. They played in the Football Conference Youth Alliance. And while I was there, obviously the first team at the time were in the conference. And the club as itself used to run, back then, before the academy system came in, used to have either a centre of excellence or an academy. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you remember, and Halifax had a centre of excellence.
Yeah.
So I used to coach down at the centre of excellence, even though I was a youth team player. I was always fascinated with that side of the game, and I thought, one, it could help me, and two, obviously everyone wants to be a top player, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. I realised very early that I may be okay, but I might not necessarily make it or do well or whatever. But I always knew that I'd be a really, you know, enthusiastic coach. I always knew I'd do better in coaching. And that was where my focus was. That's what I really enjoyed. So I started off doing that with the under-12s and with the shadow squads. Then it was going into primary schools, believe it or not, at 16 and 17, doing tying shoelaces, doing all the courses and so on and so on. And then the big one was when I started coaching in Hull. I went to university at 19, just after I got released, and alongside studying a degree, I was going into primary schools coaching. I was working for the local FA. I did one or two sessions for the local FA, and I thought, you know what, I could do this myself. And then I set up my first coaching business, Gerard School of Football. Mm-hmm. And then literally everything from there grew to where, obviously, I am now, and that's really how it started, just because I wanted to maximise individual player development. Mm-hmm. and as you're doing it, you learn along the way.
Excellent. I must congratulate you on your book. I really enjoyed reading it and got plenty from it as a grassroots coach myself and a teacher myself. Tell me, writing a book and putting your personal thoughts into print isn't easy. What parts of the book are you most proud of?
It's a good question. I think there's a lot in there that is really, really good in terms of, I'm one of those people, you'll get to learn that I'm not happy with anything, so it can always be better. So I'm actually really happy that I've got a book out, but then disappointed because I'm like, it could even be better.
Right.
And that's just my psyche. So there's a lot of stuff in there that I'm like, oh, I could have maybe done it better, or could have worded it better, this could have been better. write for my second book, that's what's going to be, you know, that's how I always think. But the main stuff in there is really just introducing the concept of using what we term game calls, you know, communication, and making sure that coaches, parents, whoever, all picking up the book, even players, mm-hmm. you know, are aware of some of the vocabulary that they can use mm-hmm. and the decisions and the actions that are attached with it. Because I think what the whole purpose of the book was to try and initiate a thought process about that so that people could take it even further. And that was something that I was really proud of with the individual learning plans and things like that for coaches, players, parents, you name it.
Absolutely. I mean, at the very beginning of the book, your book starts with the following quote. It says, coaching is about educating the players in a way that accelerates their learning and challenges them to think about the game itself. Now, to me, this is very modern teacher speak, the idea of empowering the individual to take ownership for their learning so that they can make maximum progress. As you are from a teaching background, what parallels do you draw with your time as a PE teacher and your coaching career?
There's so much, as you will know, there's so much that's correlated. Really, coaching is teaching.
Yeah.
A lot of the stuff that I draw upon is effectively how you create an environment. People talk about when they're teaching in a classroom, and obviously outdoors in our domain, and you know the training pitch is the classroom. Mm-hmm. How you're creating an environment for learning, how you're identifying individuals and what their needs are. But I think the biggest thing is the differentiation.
Mm.
How you actually differentiate. I like to separate players into A, B and C. There's something that we've introduced at my current club now where I'm, as you said before, director of coaching at Eastside FC in Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
And what we do, we'll go A player, B player, C player. Because straight away you're identifying that in that particular task, you'll have the one leading, the one in the middle, and the one who's just getting by or struggling or trying to keep up. And then how you buddy them players together. So how you'd link players a C and a B to get a benefit. I'd get a B and an A to get a benefit. So that they're building bridges and they're working together. So peer-to-peer learning. And I will do that in literally, and this is something we're doing as a club, in every activity we have. We're identifying that this player might not be necessarily this good at this particular task, but then come another task, he might be the A player.
Mm-hmm.
And how can he share that learning? So, to give you an example, on Monday, Tuesday, usually we're getting the younger ones coming in, and we do an arrival activity over here. So when the 7s and the 8s and the 10s, well, we do it across the whole club, and every age group turns up. But with the little ones, really, we have them where we've got on the board
mm-hmm.
levels. So we've got level 1 to level 6. And the levels are just skills challenges that the kids could do. So it might be the Ronaldo chop.
Mm-hmm.
So that's like a little step over and a take. Just little levels. The second one might be, that's the Ronaldo scissors.
Yeah.
Ronaldo chop, where similar to the Cruyff, but you're literally just passing the ball in between your leg.
Mm.
The third one could be invent your own skill.
Nice.
So they invent their own and they'll do it. The level 4 is show your mate, show your friend your skill. So they'll show the friend. So you've got peer-to-peer learning. And what we actually found without us even having to coach was that by creating that environment, the kids would actually explain the skill better than us to each other. It was unbelievable. If we could film it, it would have been unbelievable. And then, you know, the next level is show the coach.
Wow.
So then they show the coach what they've learned. Some might still be on level 3 or whatever. Some might skip through and blast through, and that's fine, because they're one of them that they just want to rush through. Some might take the time. So show the coach, and they're showing the coach what they're... And then that might give us an opportunity to maybe challenge them further, give them a feedback, praise them, whatever it may be, what's appropriate. And then level 6 is repeat again. Repeat level 1 to 6 again. So you got that consolidation, but you got that repetition.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of them, like I said, will want to blast through because they might get bored or whatever.
Yeah.
And that really is only supposed to last for around 10 minutes, just before the turn up, 10, 15 minutes. And it does exactly that. And then what we started doing is we started making it a competition of how many could get to level 6 and repeat and how many have completed it, not as a rush, but in a certain time frame. So we'd check it off the board. And one of the coaches then started adding reps. So you'd ask them, rather than do, like, say, one or two step overs and then they're done, then on the next level, because they might not be doing it correctly. Mm-hmm. He'd give them a repetition of how many times they could practice it. And we just started playing with it. And that's an example of some of the stuff that I've brought from teaching.
Scaffolding, learning. Yeah, scaffolding their learning, that's excellent. Like all your chapters, chapter one starts with a quote. But this first one is one that I think is quite profound and can and probably does cause endless debates. And it reads, "It's not about winning, it's about education." And you attribute it to Xavi, Barcelona's legendary former captain. Question, bit of a loaded question, is wanted to win bad? And what did you want the quote to mean to your reader?
Wanting to win is not bad. It's actually something that we need to be proud of. Because... Mm-hmm. And I'll give so many examples. There's coaches today now who are saying it's about development and their teams might get battered 10-0, whatever. And they'll go, "Oh, we're developing." That ain't development. That is not development. And what they'll do is they'll use that as a get out of free jail card. Or, that ain't development. Equally, on the other side of the coin, and I've watched this at games, opposition teams, where they're all about winning. You know, for me, your game style is important to how you want to play. We want to play, and I want to play, like in the book, a particular game style, which is possession with purpose. I don't think there's anything wrong with going in behind or over the top. That is part of your game style. But if you're doing it all the time, I think you can lose possession. I think it's important that you keep the ball and you try and move people and get people on the ball. So that they're developing the skills, especially at a younger age. And then as that evolves into senior performance, how you play is up to you to win the game. And to link on that, so we had a game recently, there was a young team at under 10s, under 11s, mm-hmm. and literally they didn't link through the midfield and they didn't play out to the back players. And what they did was they just went, because the pitch was so long and the goals were massive, Nick Levitt would love it over here. He'd be running over. He'd be going ballistic. So they're actually trying to introduce that now with the USSF. Mm-hmm. Smaller goals appropriate, pitch sizes appropriate, you know, the build-up line, whatever. But that's going on to another subject. So they just kicked it long. Now, they were winning, and they scored on free kicks and everything, and they won the game. And I was and the coach was shouting at the players and he was quite aggressive. And to me, that's winning, but winning at the detriment of learning. So that isn't right either.
No.
I do believe you have to have an edge of winning. That's why I talk about it's an education.
Yeah.
Now, to me, winning isn't important. Winning with style is important.
Good.
And I'll link that to how you want to play.
Yeah.
And your game style has to be linked to... And maybe it's because we're teachers, we can understand this more, but it's linked to a lifelong learning process of you trying to get them to where they need to be. A great coach said to me years ago, and it's stuck with me since, he said, "You're not working with an 8-year-old or a 10-year-old. You're actually working with a 25-year-old in the early part of his career."
Mm.
And that was awesome because what he told me is that where are you going with it? Where do you want that player to be when they're 25 plus?
Yeah.
What does that look like at under 10s? What does that look like at under 13s?
Yeah.
Under 7? Do you get my drift? So, and that to me is where the education process is so powerful that we need to remember what we're here for. And with that, winning does breed success. It does breed learning. Of course it does. You know, you can get people to buy into what you're trying to teach them. But... And I do want to play to win, within reason. I think across all ages, you shouldn't go into a game not wanting to win. I think that's ludicrous, but not at the detriment of learning. So, as you all know, you know, you've got little Jimmy sat on the bench who's hardly played any minutes, but you've won the game. That's bad.
Oh, yeah.
Little Jimmy needs his game time, you know, and he might not be good today, but tomorrow we could actually be better than the lads you're playing in front of him.
Absolutely.
So I think everyone's got to remember that it is an education, mm-hmm. it is a lifelong process, and we're here to try and provide an opportunity, simple as that.
Absolutely, and I agree with you. I mean, one of my frustrations when I was playing mini soccer over in England for the under-9s and under-10s, there's a retreat line rule. I'm sure you're aware of it.
Yeah.
The thing that I think the FA could have done a little bit more was to actually stop goalkeepers kicking it from their hands as well. Because you had the retreat line rule, goalkeepers are still booting it out rather than rolling it out. And, we, you know, amongst the three teams that we had at the time at my club, we encouraged all our goalkeepers to roll it out to, you know, put a player in the full-back position or in the centre-half position and turn and move it from there. But we used to play teams, as you said, used to knock it long to the, you know, the quick player up front. And to me, that sort of defeated the object. But again, that's something different. That's you know, something related but different. There's a passage in chapter one that I actually want to read verbatim, because to me it encapsulates what is bad about some coaching and how young footballers, and older ones for that matter, are simply not trusted by their coach and are afforded the responsibility to make their own decisions. And this is what I picked out. So open quote, it is no coincidence that some teams do not talk if their head coaches do all the talking for them. Whatever level I've coached at, and that's you, I've always come across head coaches screaming instructions from the sidelines. Some spectators do so too. How does this encourage, for me, so the question is then, how does this encourage player ownership and communication? It doesn't. So what is it that drives coaches to talk players throughout the game? Is there an issue with this? Whether the coach likes to admit or not, incessant talking is a sign that they don't feel confident in letting their players work things out for themselves. Instead, the coach prefers to take control, marshal the team themselves in order to micromanage how they want a game played. Close quote. Now, I see this most Sundays, and for 10-year-old footballers, surely it's a hindrance to the development rather than a help. Your thoughts, you've touched on it, but is there anything more you'd like to say on that? Because for me, that encapsulates really what your book is about and what your coaching style is about.
I think, you know, we could this one could be a really good debate and it could add a lot of discussion. I think to keep it really clear, our job when they cross the line is for them to make decisions on Agreed. Time and space.
Agreed,
that's full stop. And what we forget is that, and listen, we've all been guilty of it. I know I have. I've been guilty of it recent. You can do. You might see things that are about to happen, could happen, maybe should happen. And sometimes you may say, hey, Tom, just come round here a little bit. Or you might say, Tom, pass, or whatever. And that's not very good, because we're taking away, as Pete Sturgis says, we're taking away the decision-making. We're trying to treat them like little puppets. And that is not good. What we need to remember, and I always talk about, and it's in the book, about developing self-learners, developing independent-thinking soccer players. And that is the ultimate. If you can get players where they're making decisions for themselves and it goes wrong, they face adversity, but they can still try and figure it out themselves, or at least they'll try. And if they're still struggling, they'll ask their mate.
Mm.
And if they're still struggling, then they'll ask the coach. That is really powerful. Because I used to do it in teaching. When I used to teach BTEC Level 3 sport with the Rochdale Scholars, the futsal lads, I used to say to them, if you don't know the if there's a question, you don't know the answer, you don't know what you're doing, ask your mate. If you still haven't got the answer, ask somebody else. If you still haven't got the answer, come to me.
Yeah.
Rather than just coming to me all the time. And this is the problem, so that leads me into it. What we do is, because we talk a lot from the side, when it does go wrong on the pitch, and you see it, the first thing the players do is, the boys or the girls, they turn their head. And they're looking at the coach in the dugout for the answer, because they don't know. And then it comes to a point where the coach is always offering that answer, and then you're short-circuiting the learning process, and effectively, you know, you're not developing independent thinking footballers. And that's where I'm going with it. I think it's so more, there is a place to tell, of course. There is still a place to talk them through the game, if they're not good enough. Of course there is. There needs to come a point where, like a parent, I'm sure, if you've got kids, you do need to let them make mistakes and figure it out themselves. Otherwise, they're always going to be relying on you. And if you're always, not bailing them out, but if you're always giving them the answer, they won't think for themselves. And that's when we've got problems. And that's where I'm really going with it. I want the players to communicate effectively so that they don't actually need the coach. You're making the coach redundant, if you like. The coach is there as an observer, first and foremost.
No, excellent. I mean, a few weeks ago, in the league that we play at, we just happened to be drawn against to play another team from our club. And I spoke to the other managers and I said, listen, why don't we make this a no-instruction game? Nothing from the sidelines, from the parents, only positive reinforcement. And I said, us as coaches, we say nothing. To the point where even at half-time, I let the boys take the half-time team talk. And they were superb. They agreed amongst themselves who was going to go in goal when the next round. The only thing what I did was substitutions to ensure that they all had equal playing time. And they even decided, right, and they said this, next subs, you're going off and you're going off. We're going to go here and they're going to go in this position. It was brilliant. And that hour of football that I saw leaders in my team. I saw players wanting to take initiative, but I saw them listening to each other as well. And I thought, brilliant, that's what I want to do. I want to be quiet on the Sunday. I just want to let them get on with it. Because for me, my role is on the Friday night, coaching them through things that they may not have done on the Sunday. And it worked really well.
And to be honest with you, that's brilliant. That's a great one, because that is exactly it. I mean, I remember one of my best mentors. I've been lucky that I've come across quite a few, and one of the best ones was a guy called Tony Ellis. Mm-hmm. Oof. What he could coach, let me tell you, he can coach. And I think it's really important that you've got to find people that sometimes scare you a little bit. And he used to scare me. You know, I'd be like, oh God, I don't want to disappoint him. I don't want to let him down. And I'll never forget, he was telling me a story about Burnley when he was academy coach at Burnley before he became academy manager at Rochdale. And he literally let the players pick the team on this occasion. And now he had the team and his idea in his pocket and that. He knew what he'd probably have played. But he gave that ownership to the players. And needless to say, I know it's not what, like we said before about the winning and things like that, but the players actually produced a result and they did well for him.
Brilliant.
And it worked and they managed the game for him. And honestly, we used to do that. Me and a guy called Mark Fince, Rochdale coach years ago, I used to work with, qualified teacher. And I used to learn quite a lot by working alongside him, because we used to come to games and we'd play Bury, we'd play Preston. And he used to initiate some things like that. We used to do where we'd let the players organise a dressing room, because the coaches always put the shirts up and we make it look immaculate, don't we? And we used to give them that ownership. We used to let them decide what shape we're going to play in the next quarter. We used to give them challenges, exactly what you're talking about. Now, I think if you do that every week and week out, it loses its effect.
Oh, it does. I agree, yeah.
Yeah, I want, and also there's no real benefit for it. But certainly here and there, I think it's a really powerful one, definitely. Unbelievable.
Okay. Now, the premise of the book is game calls, and what you call game calls. Talk us through this idea. What do you mean exactly?
Well, game calls is your game-specific communication. So we all have a vocabulary. And this is a discussion that I brought up at my new club, because some coaches will describe a particular action a certain way. So they might say, I'll give you an example. We're working on defending at the minute. So one coach might say, jockey. From my Rochdale days and learning from what I learned, I would talk about surfing. And I think it's so important, especially over here in America, because they'll get it.
Yeah, yeah.
So I talk about surfing technique. I'll talk about basketball. So I've been in basketball and your technique where you sit down and you're low.
Yeah.
You're pushing off your toes, etc. We've all got a different way of describing a particular action, and that's fine. But where there becomes confusion is if you use a particular term. For example, you might say, in an attacking sense, play back. And I say, start again. So when I was coaching the American players, they would say, what was the one they used to say at Ryerson? I would say, sometimes I'd get them to shout, hold. Mm-hmm. Hold meaning, let's stay, hold this position. And they used to say something completely different. Lock on, I think it was. Mm-hmm. Lock on. Now, to me, lock on would be something that I would say if I was touching someone You know, Jamie Carragher, touch tight.
Yeah.
The ball's going to come in the box. I can feel him. Rio Ferdinand, I can feel where he is. And I can touch him and I can get my body contact in. That's what lock-on would mean to me. So straight away, we're using one word, but we mean two different things. Mm-hmm. We're both perceiving it in two different actions. So I think it's important that you have a clear vocabulary of everybody knowing exactly the terminologies you're going to use that are similar. And it can even include players, you know, using players as references. Robin, when you're talking about the movements he makes and so on and so on. But game calls for me, it's about the player. So the player will repeat these calls. So when you show them in training what start again means and where it's important to start again, it paints a picture in their mind straight away of what they can do. Right, I can't play forward. I possibly could, but that's a risk as a consequence. Mm-hmm. I'll have to play back, start again. So I'm starting again the attack in order to go forward. It's pretty simple. And by getting a player to shout, start again, that instantly tells the other player who's observing it while the game's going on that that is the opportunity to start again. Or if they said it at the wrong time, might be the wrong opportunity. Mm-hmm. So by them communicating and verbalising decisions, not only are they affecting each other and they're working together, massively important, they're learning about what they're saying, so they're getting instant feedback on what they've said, whether it was right or wrong. And the players next to them who are involved in the situation are also learning. It's so powerful. And because it's coming from them, their voice, their language, not the coaches, sometimes it actually is easier to understand. Because I don't know about you, but sometimes I'll try explaining something, it might not always work. Whereas I'll get a young player to demo it and they'll instantly get it. So that's our thought process around game calls, game-specific communication, mm-hmm. in order to retain possession or get the ball back. Very simple. And it's at every level of the game, even at the top level, they say, oh, there's thousands of people, you can't hear them. That's a load of nonsense, because I've spoken to people who have played in the Premier League, you know, and Man United and things like that. They're telling me the communication that they did. It gets to the stage, and obviously you'll know when I've put it in my book, if we're encouraging the players to verbalise decisions when they're young, by the time they're in that performance phase where they're getting a bit older, I believe, from my experience, that they actually become more non-verbal. So they're reaching that transcendent stage of learning where they can still communicate, but a lot of the decisions they do are communicating for themselves, so that they're actually making decisions on verbal, visual triggers rather than verbal. And that's when you get into that level of independent thinking. And that's why I think it's important at the younger age we get them to communicate, because not enough kids do. Not are there any kids talk these days? And we need to do something about it. And that's just one method of solving a problem.
No, I mean, I've got an example as well, actually, from my under-10s. Had a bit of a problem when they were under-9s. So my current under-11s, when they're under-9s and under-10s, where they got into a position, say, in a crossing position or a shooting position, and they didn't know what to do. So did a few sessions, and I was talking about it with my son, who was in the team as well. And I said to him, do you cross or do you find the player? And he went, isn't that the same thing? And I went, well, no. And I was trying to explain. He goes, oh, you mean sweat it. And I went, what do you mean?
And sweaty
goal from FIFA when they play FIFA. And you know what? I just said it once, and we've been using it for the last year. And the boys know exactly what it means. They'll say to someone, "Should you have sweated it or should you have crossed it?" And they know exactly what they mean. Sorry, yeah, sweated it or should you have shot? Should I say? And they know exactly what they mean. It's brilliant. And that's and I guess that's exactly what you're talking about. Yeah. Excellent. Haven't game calls always existed though? What is the difference, what you're advocating? Is it formalising it? Is that what you mean?
Well, I'll tell you now. Yes, game calls probably have existed. No, they haven't in the format that I'm introducing it. Mm-hmm. Because we will talk about, we'll say to players, you know, get tight, mm-hmm. mark up. You know, typical Sunday league or non-league, they'll go, you don't want it. I mean, that's a great shout, that. He always used to make me laugh. You don't want it. But then I took over Bradford College under 19s, and I'm hearing the goalkeeper shout, "We don't want it." And I think, oh my God, we're struggling here. You know, the players will repeat things, what the coach says, that's very simple. And the coach will shout, you know, get tight, or he'll shout, away, or get them turned, whatever. And then, tight, get tight, no turn. And the coach will shout them calls, you know. I'm sure we all have, maybe not the he doesn't want it, but you know. The players will repeat them, but the problem is all the communication has been mainly done in match day. There's been no preparation during training. So when the players hear them terminologies, if you like, which may or may not be accurate and correct to that situation, that context, whatever, they're hearing it sometimes for the first time, sometimes for, ooh, and it's on a match day. They're not actually getting shown what get tight means during training. So this is where I think the game calls are different, because we're actually programming it in our work, in our curriculum, during training. We're developing that social corner in training, so that come match day, the kids are doing it, not us doing it for the kids to do it, if that makes sense.
That's where we're
coming from, it. Because a lot of the time, and I've seen this so many times, the coach says, get tight. So the kid gets too close, he gets beaten. Coach says, you weren't tight enough. So the kid gets even closer, he gets beaten. So then the coach goes, you were too tight. So then the kid's like, oh my God. So the player's head's gone. You know, am I tight, am I not tight? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Now, if that's a term, I won't necessarily use that term. Mm-hmm. I still sometimes catch myself maybe saying it. I'm sure we all do things that we realise, ooh. But if I was using that as a vocabulary at the club, get tight, I would show them in training what get tight looks like and what that means, so that there's no confusion. And I think that's where we've gone wrong. Yes, communication to some degree has existed over the last few years, but I don't think it's been clear and concise.
Makes sense. In your book, you talk about the Minicello approach, Jessica Ennis's coach, to intervention. And it's an interesting one that you highlight. Can you talk us through this?
Well, literally, what he did, which was really clever, I think there's such an important thing where we always want to coach everything. We want to coach what we see, don't we?
Yeah.
And what I'm trying to do is program the coaches here at Eastside Football Club where we can actually leave things for tomorrow rather than achieve everything today. So we're actually working on, right at the minute, we're working on phase one, block one, which is defending in a high press. So what does that look like? What does closing down 1v1, faced up, pressure from behind, maybe tracking runners, what does that look like? All the other stuff about, you know, areas of the pitch, we're drip feeding that in, bits around protecting centre pitch, bits around, you know, compactness, bits around area specific positioning, zonal mark, I don't know, you can go on and on and on. All them things can be done a later day. Now, I think it's important that sometimes you might see something, so I'm coaching you how to defend 1v1, you're pressing at hip level, so on and so on. But maybe your foot placement's wrong. Oh, it's not what I would maybe think it needs to be. Do I coach it? Well, what happens if you're getting success?
Yeah.
And you may be getting it right. I've seen kids cross a ball and the coach has stopped them and corrected them and told them to copy his demo of how he crosses the ball, because he thinks that is the correct way to do it. When the kid had his own unique technique, it was maybe a little bit unorthodox. This is a true story. And I watched it. The kid still got the success. He got good accuracy. Why correct it? And what, relating back to the one that you just asked me about, the coach and with Jessica Ennis, she's got a different name now, hasn't she, certainly?
Yeah.
She was doing something in her running pattern, and it was to do with so many steps. And I think she'd just come back from an injury at the time, if I remember correctly, and she's retraining. And he could have told her, but he decided not to. He thought I'd neglect it, because he thought it might make her over worry about it, or maybe it might mess up her routine or whatever. And in the end, she won, obviously, a medal. Mm-hmm. She did really well.
Yeah.
And she didn't know any different, obviously, probably until he's told her. Now, if he had told her, what could have happened? Would she have still won? Would she have still been successful? And I think it's a really powerful statement that when we're giving feedback to people, something that Alex Inglethorpe says a lot, a Liverpool academy director there, he says to us, is it going to help them or is it going to harm them? Yeah. Always think about that, because if you think it might harm, don't say it. And it might not be the right time. And at that moment in time, he decided, I'm noticing something that maybe she needs to do extra step or whatever it was. I'm not going to say anything. Because he asked her, didn't he? He said to her, how are you? How do you feel? Are you okay? Do you feel happy with it? Mm. Yeah, I feel great. All right, are you sure you're happy with the technique? With the set? Yeah, feel perfect. So he's not going to jump in and go, well, blah, 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 blah. All right, okay, if you're happy, I'm happy.
That's interesting, because that's different coaching interventions and different interpretations. Now, in my experience as a grassroots coach, I've done my level two, I've done my youth modules, what you've been asked or told to do are different there as well. In level two, you'd be told to make sure the technique is correct, whereas in the youth modules, it'll be part of the guided discovery route, isn't it? So there isn't one that's correct, but maybe the message that's being given to younger coaches or coaches who are not as open to what you're professing, it's difficult, isn't it?
It is, but let's not forget, I mean, I'm an advocate of the FA, and then there's a lot of things like that, what you said there, where I'm not an advocate of the FA or the old guard, the old methods. So, to be honest with you, you're absolutely right. I mean, I've gone through every education with the FA. I've done level one, right up to UEFA A licence, and I've passed my UEFA A. Mm-hmm. I've done module one, right up to A licence in youth, and I've passed it. So, from my experience, I think that traditional strand, if you like, sorry about that, it's my phone call. The traditional strand, if you like, was too geared towards giving them the answer and things like that, and it hasn't done us any favours, I don't think. The youth award is certainly the way that we should be coaching and need to coach, and probably most people are coaching in the clubs. I think the problem, though, lied is that they perhaps, I don't know if it's right or wrong this, but maybe they needed us to do that level two. I didn't like it on the UEFA A where, we had to stop and I had to physically move players and tell them the answer and things like that. But then it did change because they were saying, well, coach how you'd normally coach. But at the end of the day, they've got to make an assessment on your learning. And from what I'm starting to think about now is, if you go, where might you need to be? And they give you the answer. How do they know that you knew that was the answer? Or I've seen coaches go, what might you do? And the kid says, I'd do this. And then he goes, yeah, that's right, and moves on. And it wasn't right, it was wrong.
Mm.
So the coach is like trying to blag his way through, if you like. Now, I think that's that assessment of getting there and show them, I think sometimes it's actually quite good, because you wouldn't necessarily coach like that week in, week out.
No.
But to be assessed for a level two or a UEFA or whatever, I think sometimes to a degree that is actually important, because you're showing the assessor that you know. But I think as well, when I started coaching in Hull, I was very much like that, because I'd come through that education, if you like. So I was like, right, stop, stand still. You need to go here. Stop. And I was intervening nearly every 2 seconds. Whereas it got to the point where I realised, hang on a minute. And then obviously I'd done the module one and I started changing my ways a little bit. But I actually think if I started off coaching like that, I wouldn't necessarily have the coaching library in my head. So I think as a coach, you need to maybe intervene and give them the answer, because from a selfish point of view, I know it might not be good for the player development, for the coach development, it helps us get the answers right in our head.
No, you're right. I mean, I nearly failed my level two because I was coaching like a youth coach. He said, you're questioning rather than telling. I goes, yeah, but that's how I, he told me to coach how I coach. But he said, I can see that you know, So show me that you know, rather than how you normally coach. So it's a bit of a contradiction, but he understood me and I did pass. But I think exactly what you're saying, had I not gone down that road, had I not experienced it, it may not give me the experience of how I am now. Hence the question, I guess, which is important.
100%. Yeah. 100%.
Gerard, in chapter 6, you introduce and give the reader some session plans with a wealth of justification of what, when and how. Central to your advice is technique, and you quote Pepin Linders, the first team development coach at Liverpool, who says the most important consideration is technique. Now it seemed like a strange question to non-coaches and fans of the game, but why do some coaches neglect technique, and why is it important in your opinion?
Well, I like to be meticulous in my detail. Certainly now, and it was hard because when I first started coaching a few years ago, in order to justify a wage, I was coaching here, I was coaching there, I was coaching everywhere.
Yeah.
I had about 5, 6, 7, blooming 8 part-time roles to equate to a full-time role, if you like, and you're actually pulling in a really good wage. Mm. But I needed them 200 quid here, 400 quid there, 600 here, 100 there, you know what I mean? I needed all them to add up to whatever it added up to. And what it taught me, because I used to struggle at first, so I used to be going from session to session, and I couldn't always prepare myself well, because I liked to be meticulous, and I started losing a little bit of that edge. But then the one thing that I always tried to remain was the technique. And that's what I learned by doing all these different roles, was that if the technique is wrong, they're going to struggle. So we're trying to teach the kids how to defend 1v1, which I don't think is taught properly anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone refers to technique as your passing technique, your finishing technique. It's all technique. It's technique in action. And for me, that is so important, because if we're giving the kids the tools on how to develop their own technique, you give them a foundation and then from there they build. They can make decisions. But if they don't have good technique, I think we're going to struggle. I think we're going to struggle because they'll come to a game and it's literally going to be, oh my God, you know, they don't know how to apply themselves in that situation.
Mm.
And that I just think the techniques are your fundamental. When I explain things to coaches, I always say, if you're fluffy in your coaching, you're neglecting the technique. Yeah. It's like teaching a kid how to handwrite.
Yeah.
So at primary school, you're not going to go, yeah, there's a pen, go on, discover, go, yeah, that's a sentence, whee. And they're all over the place, and they're like, they draw a massive circle, and they scribble here, there, and everything. No, you show them what a B looks like, and they've got to copy the B, haven't they?
Yes.
So they copy the B, they copy the C, they copy the A. They get to the point where they're copying letters, and they're putting letters together, and things like that. When they eventually got the foundations right, so they got the technique of how maybe to hold a pen, eventually they start developing their own technique of holding a pen.
That's right, yeah.
Eventually, when they start linking up letters, they start developing their own technique of handwriting. Hence, when we come to the performance stage, i.e. when we're like adults, teenagers to adults, some of us have scruffy handwriting like me, and mine's all over the place, but you can still read it. Some of us are nice and tidy and whatever. But the technique had to be instilled at the young age in order to get to that level of autonomy, where we don't have to really think about our handwriting, we just write, don't we?
Yeah.
And I think that's the best way to explain it, and that's why, for me, it is fundamental.
Excellent. Right, so Gerard, Celtic practices, and these are some of my favourite practices, and when a parent or casual onlooker, you know, looks at them, thinks that the player's all over the place and there doesn't seem to be any structure, you know, and you call them Celtic practices, and do you think they have a place in coaching? Explain to our listener what they are and how important they can be in the development of young footballers.
It is important, and it's important, I think, our role to actually explain to the parents what we're doing. It's something that we're doing now in my role, where we're involving the parents as much as we can, giving them an education and explaining to them the curriculum and what we're working on. But you're absolutely right. I mean, chaotic can look messy, but messy is good. A lot of coaches, and often we're sometimes actors,
So we're trying to play to an audience, if you like. And we're always worried about how it looks, you know, the setup. The cones set up perfect, the cones fantastic laid out. They go from this practice to that practice. The, you know, the passing, but it doesn't always have to look like that. That's more for the parents' benefit rather than the children's. A lot of the stuff we do when we talk about chaos learning is where they're involved in random type practice designs or variable. In other words, there's a lot of movement in there. There's a lot of changing. So there's different changes in choice. The players have got choice, they've got direction, they've got interference, and they've got some degree of pressure on the ball, whether it's full or part opponent pressure. There are practices that you can do where I'll do passing and receiving. They can play to any player, but you'll have one game going on one way and another going on another. You know, within the practice, it looks really messy. Players have got to identify who's on their team, how to avoid people, where the space is, how to make sure they keep the pass without passing into another player, all sorts of different things. So that's without pressure on the ball, but there's still that interference, that choice, that direction, that decision making. And they're vital because the game, as you know, is chaotic, is random. And I think if we can push them towards that, I always talk about the importance of getting towards that 100% realism. And if we can get as close to it as possible, that is great. When we talk about practices where it's passing to a cone and a player's moving off a cone to pass to another player on a cone, they're fine. You can get repetition in there. There'll be a lot of repetition, and it might look really nice and tidy, but what you'll probably find, as you will know, is there's no actual correlation to what will happen in the game. So it develops low context, low-level thinking skills, because the players don't actually have to perceive and think about the decision that they're going to act upon, because it's just happening. There's no conscious thought needed.
That's right. That's like the
whereas when you get them in a situation where you're stressing them, what were you going to say, sorry?
I was going to say, it's like the practice spectrum, isn't it? Where it's low to high, isn't it?
Yeah, that is exactly it. And it's literally, because there's so much going on, you know yourself, and there's so much movement, they've got to develop higher level thinking skills. They're thinking about consequence. They're thinking about weight of pass. They're thinking about the touch. They're thinking about where the space is. They're thinking about every sort of little decision that is so relevant to what they're going to have to do in a game when they've got all them players around them and they've got to make decisions on, and I go back to it, time and space.
Absolutely.
Time and space limitations. And that's the key. If we can involve them in as many type of practice designs as that, that is the key. That is fundamental.
Excellent. Chapter 7 of the book focuses on the power of communication, and you quote Bill Beswick, who looks at how attitude can drive performance and prioritising effective communication as a key for successful teams. Where do you personally stand on the debate between ability versus attitude? Can you have one without the other, or are both mutually dependent for success?
It's a tough one, because I don't think it's as simple as you can answer it. Yes, it's this, and yes, it's that. I think that'd be a very naive comment if I said something like that. But from my experience, working with different players, I think your attitude, your mental toughness and your emotional control, your mental strength, every player is a confidence player. Every person in your life is a confidence person. Something that we stress a lot in the book. You know, Brendan Rodgers actually spoke about it. I was at a conference many years ago with the LMA, and he was manager of Swansea at the time, and he came and presented at the LMA conference, and he spoke about players having tattooed, not literally, but talking about they have tattooed on their forehead, make me feel special.
Yeah.
And I think everyone has to have confidence. You know, that is your biggest, most important skill, confidence, because without it, you can't do anything. And to go back to hopefully trying to answer your question, I think your attitude, your motivation in life, I always talk about this, your motivation will go up and down, ebb and flow. You know, you're not always going to be, same as us as coaches. I like enthusiastic coaches, energetic coaches, people that have a great manner and that can impart information as well as facilitate information. But you're not always going to have, because you will have moods, you'll have things happen in your life, as will the players, you'll have a bad day at school. There's all sorts of scenarios. So for me, your motivation and your energy can go up and down. but your attitude must remain consistent. And that is so important. So what I look for is people's confidence and their attitude, the mental strength is that they want to try and be the best they can be. They want to try and learn. They want to try and put the as effort as they can in to achieving what they want to achieve. They've got a vision of where they want to go. They might have a limited ability, but the ones who have that mindset of my attitude will remain consistent, they're the ones that are going to excel. And they're the ones that are going to push on even further.
Excellent. Right, more so than in any time in the game, and maybe it's because we see a lot of it on TV now, we see coaches during top-level matches show substitutes reams of paper where they should be on the field of play, set pieces, different situations. And when I see that recently, it just occurred to me, how far away are we from having a situation that is really similar to American football, with coaches making specific game calls during the game to alter patterns of play, formations, tactics, and so on? I mean, is this what you foresee, and is this too far from what you advocate with regards to game calls?
Do you know what? It's already happening at the top level. It's already happening at the top level. The very top level is already happening. There's certain trigger words, game calls that managers and coaches are using on set plays, as well as visual cues, to get an edge over on the opponent. There's a clear vocabulary from the manager. If you look at Pep Guardiola, you look at Mourinho, you look at Wenger, you look at even Van Gaal, all the managers, they'll have a clear vocabulary of how they will describe how they want their game style to be played and what scenario, certainly on set plays. You speak to Tony Pulis. Tony Pulis is a set play expert.
Yeah.
So a lot of the time, he will identify the opposition and he will create a strength to outplay your weakness. Mm. He'll identify where in your set play you can concede goals.
Mm.
And from that, then happy days. And that's what he does. And he'll have certain trigger words, game calls as we call them, to think about. And the game calls, as well as being verbal, they'll actually evolve into non-verbal with gestures. You look at Eddie Howe, when the guy's taking the corner, the lad who's taking the corner will raise on his toes. So he'll step up on his toes, and then as he drops onto the floor, so his heels make contact with the floor and he's about to kick the ball, that's the trigger to set your run off.
Oh, wow.
There's all sorts of little things at the top level and even further beyond when you're talking Champions League and so on, that there is real fine detail. And a lot of that's been existent in basketball.
Yes.
And in American football.
That's right.
And it's coming in. I mean, obviously, you know, in rugby, there are certain calls, what people use to describe certain plays, attacking and defending. Mm. They've done this for years in rugby. And it's starting to introduce itself in football. I foresee in the future that across most levels, it will probably become more existent as people realise the power of communication, verbally and non-verbally. And I think there'll be more clarity and more conciseness of what the coach actually wants from his players because of that. But I think at the minute, there's a big divide across grassroots, amateur, non-league, and lower league at professional levels all over the world. Probably there's a big divide of some that do, some that don't. But at the very top level, they're already doing it. And that's where I think it's going to go and can get better. And it's certainly something that my role now as director of coaching at Eastside FC, we're already introducing it because we want players that have got the social skills, social learning theory. They could actually impart information. And as part of our curriculum, we look at age phases. So in England, you've got foundation phase, youth development phase, professional development phase.
Yeah.
And I think that's right, but I also think it's wrong because it doesn't actually say to you what the priorities are at 12 to 16. It just says youth development.
Yeah.
It doesn't tell you what we're looking for at them ages. So within our game style, the foundation phase, we call that the ball mastery phase, where we're looking to govern the ball, stay on the ball, master the ball, 5 to 11. 12 to 16, we call that the skillful possession phase.
Yeah.
So now they're getting to make decisions on time and space. They can actually know when and where to dribble, when and where to pass, how to press high, how to tactically protect centre pitch when they're 16, and they're learning all these skills. Mm-hmm. And then at 17 to 21, we call it game leaders. So we're looking at the players right up until under 18 in our club. We're looking at them, how can they affect each other? And because they've been doing game calls at such a young age, they've got that. Some of them will have it at the skillful possession phase. Some of them will definitely have it when they're under 17, under 16, under 18 with us. Because what they'll do when they're preparing for college, soccer over here, Division 1 to 3, and higher with the PDL, NASL, MLS, hopefully, they're preparing for that. How can they influence the referee within reason? How can they influence each other? Hey, you need to get tight, you need to do this, you need to, you know, organising midfielders. There's an overload. They're giving people responsibilities. How they can encourage people. You listen to Rio Ferdinand. Rio Ferdinand would shout at Wayne Rooney. Wayne Rooney's missed the target. He would shout at him, Wazza, finish. Wazza, what's going on?
Yeah.
That would be... Then the game calls evolve into something else. How you manage and jab and give people responsibility. So Wayne would be like, you know what, I'm not having that. So on the next one-on-one, surprise, surprise, Wayne would score. Because he's got to prove a point to Rio Ferdinand and anybody else who's doubting him. But it's not that Rio's doubting him. That's Rio's way of giving him an edge, giving him a little thing. Rio used to do it with Ronaldo. So it evolves into something else. Ronaldo, Rio used to go, you know, there was only one David, there was only one number seven, you know, at Man United. There was only ever really one. The number seven for me, David Beckham. That would drive Ronaldo mad. He'd be like, you know what? I want to be the number seven. I'm the number seven. So Ronaldo will get a bag of balls and he'd be off practicing his free kicks. I'm going to be better than Dave Beckham. And it evolves into the game leaders, that social learning theory. So if we can get the kids to talk, as simple as when to start again, when to play around, when to twos, little one-two, when to press, when to hold, and so on and so on. The simplest game calls that I've introduced in the book, we get them to actually have the confidence to speak to each other. And then when they get to that teenage years, and young man years, and young woman's years, then they get to that level where they can actually go a bit further. They can start being leaders, can start being captains, they can start have to have autonomy and responsibility. And then I call it the performance phase. 21 to 25 and beyond is your performance phase. That is when we're looking at, do you know what? All them things that we worked on when you were a kid to now, you've actually got to start putting it in.
Realising your potential.
Now we are expecting it. Yeah, what you just said there. Yeah. We're realising it and things like that. Yeah. There's an expectation now. I don't want the performance phase to be at under 10s.
Yeah, makes sense.
Yeah, you want to do well, but that's not right. That's not ethically right. Yeah. Whereas when they're 21 and when they're 25, when they're 23, they're still developing. We need to give them that time. But there's an expectation now. Whereas what we do in England, I know I'm in America now, luckily, but what we do in England is, you know, you haven't made it by 17, 18, goodbye.
Yeah.
15, goodbye.
It's true.
And it's true, isn't it? Yeah, we don't keep them until 23. And if you look at players, when they actually met some of their big money signings, when they go abroad, they sign for teams, they sign with a 23, 24, 25. That's when you can start to tell the potential. I would give them to that time. I would loan them out. I wouldn't even play under 21 football.
No.
I'd get the kids playing at non-league level or lower league level, if possible. Non-league is great, or even playing abroad. Because of my experiences, seeing the structures and having an insight into what's going on in Finland, what's going on in Norway, what's going on in all these places, I would be loaning players to them countries 100%. Get them playing senior football. They know how to become a player. Mm. Then they come back with strength. You know, you look at, well, there was
Dele
a picture recently of Harry Kane and all that.
Yeah.
And they were on loan at a club, weren't they? Sat in the dugout together. Yeah. What a picture.
Yeah.
What a picture. And obviously I've gone off on a tangent there, but from the game calls, it can manifest into so much more. And I think that's how we've got to do it. And that's how we've got to scaffold that learning. Like I said in the early part of our interview, you're not working with a 10-year-old. You're not working with an 8-year-old or an 11-year-old. 13-year-old, you're working with a 25-year-old in the early part of their career. Where do we want them to be when they're 25 and beyond? Where do we want them to be when they're 30, 35? You know, we want a good person. We want the person before the player. But then there are certain traits that we want as a player. What will that look like? And that's the key. And this is what I'm really excited about, because if we can share this knowledge out, people can introduce this at the lower levels.
Absolutely.
In English football, a grassroots up, which is great. And this is what I'm trying to do with this club here. At the minute now, we've got around 800 players. We've got an unbelievable programme. We've got under-7s right up to under-18s. And we've got some really strong players. And I'm hoping that we can actually start implementing them things so that we see the fruitions of it over here. And then eventually, you know, so hopefully we can see that in England and everywhere else.
Superb, brilliant. I mean, following on, I guess that the modern PlayStation and FIFA playing generation are probably better equipped to process game calls purely because it's part of their virtual game experience. So what they do with the controller in their hand, they've got that skill of being able to implement game calls and changing things because they're used to it, and it's got on the pitch, and it's sort of easier for them than, say, my generation.
That's a, yeah, I've never considered it like that, but you're right.
Excellent. I was fascinated by a section where you introduced ZPD, Zone of Proximal Development. Now, as a teacher, I know how powerful effective feedback can be and how harmful a lack of feedback can be. Talk us through ZPD and how useful it is to footballers, coaches and probably parents even.
I just think the key is knowing what to say. It's so difficult, even now. You can never always get it right, but the power is stretching people. For me, the first thing you've got to know, I mean, obviously, zone of proximal development, we want to try and scaffold that. It's from the research of Vygotsky, and you're looking at scaffolding the learning, but you're looking at stretching them, aren't you? Get them to out of their zone and extending that potential. The key for me is if there isn't a relationship, you can't say anything.
Right.
It's the same with me and my staff. If they don't respect me and I don't respect them and they're in a trust and a some degree of love there, if I go up to one of them and say, listen, you know, you're talking too much or you're doing this or doing that, from some of the things that I've done myself and now I know better, hopefully, or anything, if I want to give them feedback, or even the players, if there ain't a relationship there, it's not going to work because straight away he thinks or she thinks you're having a dig.
Mm-hmm.
There has to be a relationship. That's the first thing that I think people and parents certainly need to be aware of. I'm not saying some parents don't have a relationship with the kids, but that relationship, it can sometimes be hostile. I was lucky with my dad. There was a really good relationship there where I'd listened to my dad and I knew he wasn't having a go if it was worded in the right way. He was trying to, but he'd also know as a parent when to lay off, when to say nothing. But you've got to give that feedback is powerful. I think they know in themselves and they can reflect. I think if we can give them skills to be self-learners and reflect upon what they're doing, that's going to be more powerful than me or you giving them information or asking them a question to get the information out of them. I think if we can start to ask them questions, but get them to ask themselves questions, I think that's powerful to get towards that ZPD and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something I'm going to be talking about in my second book, Self-Learners, Developing Self-Learners.
Excellent.
I think the key is, for me, when you're giving, you've got that relationship, the feedback, how you do it. Everybody has a different way of learning. There's so much literature out there that it can be misunderstood. As you will know as a teacher, you know, people talk about he is a visual learner. He is a kinesthetic, and that's a lot of nonsense because you don't have a, for me, it's not a set learning style. It's a preferred learning style, which is context specific. Sometimes I want to be shown. Sometimes I want to be told.
Mm.
I don't want to go for that. I just want to be known the answer and then I can think about it. Sometimes I want to be asked a question. But if you always ask him a question, it becomes monotonous. Doesn't work, doesn't have its effect. And I think in order to get that ZPD and stretch their learning, stretch their feedback and offer them feedback, you've then got to know, in order to do any of those things, how are they going to learn in this situation? We had a player at Rochdale when I was there as an academy coach with the 14s. He didn't like to be stopped.
Hmm.
Not that many kids do, but what I mean is he didn't even like, the game's still going on, you'd have an individual chat with him.
Yeah.
He did not like that.
Wow.
Now, as part of the Youth Awards, we're talking about that, aren't we? We're That's talking right. about, you know, punt at the side. He didn't like that. Didn't like the question. Didn't like being told the answer. Didn't like you stopping him while the game's going. So I had to learn very quickly, how does this kid learn? So yeah. I didn't have a clue. So I asked him, I said, what do you prefer? He said to me, and he was an under 14, or what's his name, good player. He said to me, I prefer to be told when it's a drink break. I just want to play the game. And see things and figure out. I still want you to show me. I'd rather you show me than ask me a question. So he's telling you, I want to see it. And he was a midfielder. He liked to see things. So with him, I'd wait till it was a water break or after the training session or whatever. And it's off the side, so it's not during the game. So I'm letting him play. But on the side, I would show him on the board. And I'd show him things. I'd try and show him a video, short and sweet. And that would scaffold his learning. That would achieve that ZPD because I'd give him a challenge. I'd set him football homework or I'd give him a challenge within the next... We've had a water break. I've shown him a video. I've moved the markers on the tactics board. And then I'd be, go on, off you go. And then the next 5-10 minutes, or if we're doing 8-minute games, in that 8-minute game, he'd be playing uninterrupted and he's having to figure it out. And that'd stretch his learning, that ZPD. And I think that's really important because a lot of coaches... to forget the fundamentals in order to achieve all these things, which we talk about in the book. Relationship, confidence, how do they learn? It's preferred learning style.
Yeah, excellent.
And you've got to know your learners. That's the bottom line. You've got to know your learners. You've got to know the history of your player.
Yeah. That's part of the social corner, the FA of the four corners, part of the social, isn't it? We're getting to know your players, maybe beyond the football pitch as well as on the pitch.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's massive. I don't think you can ever know them enough, really.
No.
That's why I try and... I think you've got to be careful. I think some coaches are too familiar with parents, and I don't think that's very good. But I do think it's important to have a communication with parents, because who should know that kid better than anybody? You know, and with him, you know. So if you have an insight into that parent and what they're like at home and things like that, or what they're like at school, if you can speak to their teachers at school... Any feedback for us as coaches is good because then we can help them.
Mm.
And that's what I used to do. I used to just ask them. I used to speak to the player. How can you, how can, when I went to AZ Alkmaar, AZ Alkmaar Academy, every player has an individual learning plan to maximise their strengths. But it's through a series of, a couple of questions, very short and sweet. And one of the questions is, who do you need the support from? So the kid will go, maybe the physical trainer or the head coach or this coach or psychologist, whatever it is, sports science. And what do you need from them or what do you want from me? When would you like to meet to reevaluate, review this? What time scale do you want to set on this? The kids have to decide who they're learning from, what they're learning and how often and when they're going to review it. I think that is unbelievable.
Mm.
So every kid and the coaches themselves have then a plan from that player. That's what they do at AZ Alkmaar.
Wow.
And every coach then knows this player wants support from this particular coach because of the skill set that coach has and what he can offer. And we're going to review that in maybe 10 weeks.
Wow.
And things like that, unbelievable.
I mean, that leads on to the next question that I had. And I love the part where you talk about the individual player reviews. And I never thought of doing it with my under-11s, even though I have seen it used for academy players. And would you say you have used it with players, you say you've used it with players as young as 8. Is that too young, and what effect does this have on the player and their parents? I'm talking at grassroots rather than at elite or an academy level. Is it something that I should be looking to do at grassroots, or is it more for the elite players?
No, I think it's for anybody. I think the document would be different.
Yeah.
To be honest with you, I didn't even necessarily... They use the written document as much with the 8-year-olds, because they're only 7, the under-8s.
Yeah.
But what I would do is I'd have a conversation with them. I knew exactly what their strength was. Because we're a coach, for me, is an observer,
That's first, right. And
foremost. So you spot what they're good at. Then what I would do is I'd challenge them in a certain way, and I'd agree something with them and the parent, and I'd say to the parent, this is what we're doing with your son. Oh, brilliant. Mm. He's quite good at dribbling, but maybe he needs to work on... He's, you know, he's changed speed once he's beaten the player. It's not the first defender you've got to worry about, it's the second. Or it might be his passing range or whatever it may be. Let's, you know, we're speculating. And then he would have that plan, it'd just be a one bullet point for me.
Yeah.
Whereas the template that I've got in the book could be more for the coach's benefit rather than the player. The player doesn't necessarily have to see that. If it was an academy, you could use that template for the player and the coach and the parent. Or if they're older kids... You know, U11, U12 upwards, you can use that template.
Yeah.
And you can adapt it. What I learned is that 3 points can be too many. I think it's a lot easier to focus on one strength
Yeah.
And one development point. I don't like the word weakness.
No, I agree.
So, like, you know, like when people say, oh, your weaker foot.
No, your other
foot. A lot of nonsense.
Your other foot.
Yeah. Or you could say your non-dominant foot. Or, yeah. Like, to a kid, obviously, if you said under eight, non-dominant, what's that? It's funny, isn't it?
Yeah.
You wouldn't say that. But you could say, like you said, your other foot. Or some of the kids have told me this is my best foot and that's my other foot.
Best foot.
Or this is my strong foot. Yeah. Or like one kid said to me, hey, well, funny, under nine,
yeah.
This is my favourite foot.
Oh, I love
all
that.
Right, fair enough. We need to work on your other favourite foot then,
yeah.
Or your non-favourite or whatever, yeah. You know. So it's fun. The kids will come up with names and that's fine.
Yeah.
You know, but I don't like the word weakness. I always talk about a development task.
Yes.
Development point, you know, so you can develop it, but maximise the strength. And yeah, I hope that answers it. You know, yes,
yeah.
You can.
Yeah,
but how you package it, as you know, is going to be different. And for others listening, how you package it for that under 8, under 10, whatever, it might be different and probably is different. How you'd package it to an under 16, under 18, under 21, so on.
Yeah, makes sense. Another quote from your book, which I found in chapter 8 and personally resonates greatly with me, and again, I'll mention it, and you say, quote, so what will the vision become for a player of the future? My belief, and that's you, is that players of the future will have no set positions. Instead, they will be so technically proficient and tactically strong, as well as physically and psychologically tough, that they can play in any position at any moment in time, end quote. Now, I've also interviewed Matt Whitehouse, who you make mention of in your book, and I got him to come down and do a coach and a coaches session at my club, which was a great success. And he too advocates what you say, and he calls it universality. Now, unfortunately, all too often on a Sunday, when I'm maybe changing my goalkeeper to be my centre forward, or swapping players who are in defence, into more attacking positions, the opposition are rigid and in extreme circumstances, and we've heard it all before, where their biggest players are the central defender, the fastest on the wing or up front, they just knock it long.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, to me, this is probably anathema to player development. What can we do about this? How can we change people's perception? Because what Matt says and what you say for me is how grassroots coaches should be.
I think it's something for the FA. I mean, FA at the minute, the problem is that the island is like the size of, if you compare the island to over here, where I am, I'm in Michigan.
Yeah.
That's England. You can fit England in there, I think. You know, and it is massive. And that's just an island. And it's so hard for the FA to have enough staff to get around. They're trying to introduce this FA club mentor scheme, aren't they, where the coaches will go in and try and mentor the grassroots. I think the key is an investment in grassroots to just try and offer some solutions and examples where coaches watching it can go, okay, that's different. Because the key is, we can't pigeonhole the kids. This would be my advice. They can't pigeonhole them into set plays and like, he's a big boy, he's playing there and things like that. You can't do that. Because when they come to 14 and 15 and 12, there's going to be other kids that may have had a better experience that they'll understand the game better.
Yeah.
It's like in, is it netball or netball, I believe it is, where they actually, you have to rotate positions. So they'll play them in different positions so that they've got a better game understanding of the game.
Mm.
I'm sure it's a sport. Now, I could be wrong on that one, but I think that is the whole concept, that they're getting an understanding of every role.
Yeah.
And they're getting proficient in them positions. Now, we've got to be careful, because what we do is we offer this as advice, so then someone listening will go, right, that's what I've got to do. And it's like from one extreme to the next. So we've got a problem where we take people too literally. So then what we do is we play kids in all sorts of different positions, you know, and they get battered. By that I mean they lose loads of goals, they lose confidence, they're not playing to their strengths, and that doesn't develop either.
No.
I think what you've got to do is you've got to identify what kids' strengths are and what their interests are. Forget dad.
Yeah.
Dad, my son's a striker. No, forget that. What is the kid want? What, it's about the kid for me. Now, what does the kid want? Where does the kid best? If their best position is when you're starting to get like under nines upwards and they're playing in a certain position and there might be a striker, for example.
Mm.
I think because of the games we play, you can let them play in that position for a certain amount of time. But then it's the coach's job to manage the work and explain to them that I might play you in this position, but then I might play you as a centre-half
Yeah.
for a certain amount of time. maybe not 50-50, but it might be more 70-30 or whatever it is, you know, percentage-wise. That's up to the coach to decide. But then the kid's getting an experience. Oh, right, and this is some of the movements a striker might have to make. And they will figure it out. They won't think of it as deeply as us adults do, obviously, but they will figure it out. And I think that's how you manage it. I've managed teams over here and other places where I've played a player even as old as 19, and I've played him in his best position, and I've played him in a development position.
Mm.
And for this, maybe the second half, or if we've played a weaker team, I don't mean to use that word weak because I don't like it, but if you're playing a team that's maybe not as strong,
yeah,
I've played him in that development position, so he can build confidence, and it's okay. And then against the stronger teams or in other things, I've played him in his strength, because we can't forget the strengths. Absolutely. You know, you are who you are. And you know that. I've seen kids where they get told, oh, you're too big, need to lose a bit of weight. Hang on a minute, that's his body type.
Yeah.
Some people have got a body type where they're naturally, for want of a better word, chunky.
Yeah.
No, it's not a very good example, but they could be a bit chunky. So for me, that we've got to identify what is the strength of that person and then build on from there. And that'd be my advice, because then that can develop so that in the future, you understand the game, you understand different positions, they understand rotation, and we get them that good where they can play in any position and they understand what they're doing.
Absolutely. I mean, there's a lad in my team, and I mean, I know his dad will probably want him to be more of a forward or a midfielder, and his dad doesn't, you know, he doesn't like try to coerce him or tell me or whatever, but I could sense it from the conversations. And I do normally play him in an attacking or midfield role, but sometimes I play him at the back because I know that he's very, very good on the ball, and I can see leadership qualities in him. And I'll say to him, today I want you to just be the boss at the back. You got the responsibility to bringing the ball out. And every time I've played him this season, he's been man of the match for me. He's been brilliant. And I think he's getting it. And I think his dad's getting it as well. But all the other players are understanding it as well. And it's, as you said, don't just move him about for moving about's sake. Just say, oh, experience right back or right midfield. It's putting it there for a purpose and possibly, you know, the bigger picture.
That's it. That is it.
Yeah. I mean, you end your book by telling the reader that you hope it has stretched their learning. And having read it myself, I can certainly attest to this. It has stretched me. It has given me some thoughts as well for my, you know, with my under-11s. I mean, there is plenty
Thank
that
you.
I will use in the classroom too. So for me, it's served a dual purpose. I mean, you know, from your experiences, you know, what other books do you recommend to our listeners or to coaches who are eager to grow and learn?
Well, it's a very good question, that. I mean, I think the key, do you know what I recommend people to do? Try and read literature, academic literature.
Yeah.
I know it's not easy because often some of the stuff they talk is in jargon.
Mm.
And it's like, what does that actually mean? It's not in English. But I would recommend people Google references and Google literature, because I think there's so much research that's been out since the 80s that, you know, is actually coming into play now. And that knowledge has been about since then.
Yeah.
But we're only now starting to talk about more game-based coaching, more realism. We're only now talking about, you know, less is more. We're talking about the balance between play and practice. There's a guy called Lordner in Australia, New Zealand. He's worked between them areas. You know, you've got Kidman, who's out in them sort of areas, Oceania. Mm-hmm. Lordner talked about in 2001, I believe it was, play practice, which was an add-on from teaching games for understanding. And he was talking about balancing the balance between play and practice and making sure that they get an opportunity. That knowledge has been around there now. His book came out in 2001, I believe. That's 15 years old.
Yeah.
People are only just talking about that now. So I would recommend people to, if they can, even though some of it is in jargon, try and get on Google and have a look at some academic literature. And then on top of that, you know, I believe Kidman, Developing Decision Makers, if I've got a title of a book right, but it's along decision makers and developing them. Kidman's a great author to look at. I believe Matt Whitehouse's book on universality would be an interesting read for anyone.
Yeah.
And there's obviously the traditional ones that everyone's talking about, Talent Code and all these others, Sports Gene and what have you. I think, for me, I always look at rather than reading loads and loads and loads of books, find out what you want to be as a coach, find out what your strength is. I want to be an academy manager. Mm-hmm. And then from academy manager, either manifest into and gravitate into being a first team coach, head coach. So I have an understanding. I'm in my mid-20s, mid to late 20s now. Mm. So I've got quite a long time frame left on. That's my vision. So a lot of the books I'm reading are Alex Ferguson, Harry Redknapp's autobiography. I'm reading soccer coaching books. I'm reading academic literature because they're relevant to me.
Yeah.
I think the best advice, rather than name names of books, is, you know, what is it that you want to really find out and what is it that you want to be as a coach, and then explore from there, because they're the books that you want to read that will have value to them as a person.
Excellent. No, thanks for that advice. Finally then, Gerard, if you had the power to change one thing about the game, what would it be and why? Could be laws of the game, could be something that the FA should implement, or it could be anything. What would it be?
Do you know what? It's a really tough question because there's so many things, I'm sure, that anyone and everyone would, you know, yourself, there's so many that you could have. It's like out here, they've got kids at under 12s playing with a size 4 ball.
Right.
Which I've got to be careful. I don't mean that to be disrespectful to anyone. It's just something different. My first game out here in America was at a training facility that you would not believe. The facility was unbelievable. Like a Category 1, 2 academy facility. It was unbelievable. Yeah. But the size of the goals that the under-11s team that I was coaching had to defend in the keeper was absolutely crazy. It was massive. You know what I mean? And the pitch was massive. Now, we've tackled that issue, or Nick Levitt has tried to tackle them issues with facilities and goals and pitch sizes.
That's right.
And USSF are tackling that now. And they're putting in restricted, you know, mandates now with the birth mandate over here, the heading rule, you're not allowed to practice or train heading or play with heading from under 11s below. The stuff around, you know, 4v4, 7v7, 9v9, 11v11, just relevant ages over here, which happens in Europe. So I think everyone's doing the right things and along the right things. And I think national government bodies are catching up. One thing is really tough because there are some things within that offer trade-offs that we've got to be aware of. If I'm going to say one thing, it'd be this. Remuneration.
Yeah.
Because I think there has to be... There's so many good coaches out there that might not have a UEFA A. Like, I mean, I've got a UEFA A. They might not have that. They might not have a B or an FA Level 2 or whatever. Mm-hmm. But they're actually really good coaches. They might even be better.
Yeah.
But because they haven't had the financial support, they've got a job, they've got a wife, they've got kids, they've got responsibilities, they can't necessarily go, oh, I'm going to quit to become a coach. You know, the professionalism and the structure at the minute is good, but it's not set for someone like that to take the gamble, if you like, you know, risk the mortgage and things like that. For someone like me, so lucky that I started young.
Yeah.
You know, and I could build up, I could go off and do things, and I'm at the stage where I am now, where in the future I'm going to reap the benefits. I think even still, the remuneration is very good. I mean, I'm on a good living at the minute, but, you know, I'm sure for the guys in England where your academy coach is, you know, Faze Leeds, some of them are on 15, 16 grand a year, 18 grand a year.
Yeah, it's not good,
some jobs are 20, it's not good, 24 grand a year and things like that. No, it's not about the money, and everyone knows that. It's about what you're doing. But within that, if you want a certain level of expertise, you've got to pay it. And I think there's so much money at the top level that I know they're whittling it down. I know they are. But perhaps there could be more. I think there's got to be a commitment where we're paying the under-12s coach, you know, a good salary, as well as paying the under-21s coach or whatever. I think there has to be a better remuneration structure in England, and probably in most countries, to justify people, you know, wanting to become a coach over here. You know, there's a situation over here where I'm sure some of the coaches, the local coaches over here, would love to do what we're doing, coaching soccer every day, as they call it over here.
Yeah.
But they, because of the health insurance and things like that in America, they probably couldn't take that risk. You know, and there's so many structures all over the world, and obviously back in England. I just think if they can have a financial package that rewards people, I think that's absolutely fantastic.
No, that makes sense.
That would be my one thing.
That's a good point. Gerard, that wraps it up. Thanks so much for your time. And thank you for your book as well. I mean, personally, I would urge all coaches, but parents of young footballers too, to have a read. Is there anything that you'd like to say to our listeners before we say goodbye?
Thanks, Alice. Today, appreciate your time. If anyone wants to get in touch, they're absolutely welcome to get in touch. Follow me on Twitter at Gerard, Gerard underscore Jones, Jones. And obviously, I'd love it if you could buy the book. That'd be great. As a giggle. On a serious note, if you want to get in touch, come follow us on Twitter. I'm here to support everyone, because for me, everybody's in the same boat. Mm. We're all in the same boat. We're all learning. We're all trying to get somewhere. My email is jones@eastfc.org, EASTFC.org. And if anyone wants to give me an email or ask you a bit of advice or anything, parents, whoever, whatever, you know, feel free to get in touch.
Brilliant, brilliant. So, I mean, I really enjoyed that. Listeners, that was Gerard Jones. This is Michael Pieri for Shoot the Defence. I hope you've enjoyed listening to it as much as I did talking to Gerard. For more information about Shoot the Defence, follow us on Twitter at Shoot the Defence. Check out our webpage, www.shootthedefence.com, and download previous podcasts from iTunes. Until next time, goodbye.